After the movie Free Willy became a hit, word got out that the star of the film, a killer whale named Keiko, was sick and still living in a tiny pool in a Mexican amusement park. Fans were outraged. Kids demanded his release. I'm Daniel Alarcón. From Serial Productions and the New York Times comes The Good Whale, a story about the wildly ambitious science experiment to return Keiko to the ocean. Listen to new episodes on Thursdays. Want early access to the whole show? Subscribe to The Times at nytimes.com/podcasts to listen on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, an expansion of power, a rewriting of the Constitution. Is democracy coming to an end in Venezuela? And what will it mean for President Trump to bring a four-star military general into a chaotic White House? It's Wednesday, August 2nd.
By sanctioning Maduro, the United States makes clear our opposition to the policies of his regime and the support for the people of Venezuela.
Nick Casey, the last time we spoke to you about Venezuela, you described a pretty grim picture there, a hunger epidemic, mass protests in the street, and a president who has been cracking down on freedoms of all kinds. How does that connect with these actions by the Trump administration against the Venezuelan government?
The U.S. is trying to find something it can do.
What we're seeing is the brutal oppression of the Venezuelan people.
To intervene in this situation, which is getting out of control.
And this is happening, obviously, at an accelerated pace in recent months.
There's sanctions against a head of state.
As a result of today's sanctions, all assets of Maduro subject to U.S. jurisdiction are frozen, and U.S. persons are prohibited from dealing with him.
And that's pretty unusual.
Right.
There are only four heads of state now that have got sanctions against them.
Maduro himself, he joins a very exclusive club.
The others, in addition to Maduro, are Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, Bashar al-Assad in Syria, and Kim Jong-un in North Korea.
Wow. I mean, that's a really ugly list of people who, according to the United States, have essentially committed crimes against their own people. So have we actually come to the point in Venezuela where the president is in the same league as an Assad or a Mugabe?
I think that of this small club of dictators, that definitely and fortunately for Venezuelans, they haven't seen Mugabe-style actions on the part of Maduro. But I think the fear is that if we turn the clock ahead and it's 2020 and Nicolas Maduro is an aging man who is still in charge of Venezuela because of these moves that he's taken this month, we could potentially have someone that looks like an aging Robert Mugabe on the throne.
So what has Maduro done this month? What's been going on?
So Maduro called a vote to rewrite the Constitution and establish a group that, in the meantime, would be running the country. He didn't ask voters whether they wanted a new constitution. All you got to vote on was who was going to write it. Mm-hmm. And the people on the list of who were going to write it were people who were all very close to the president. Imagine if in the U.S. someone had said, we're going to rewrite the U.S. Constitution. You would expect at first they would say, do you want to rewrite the
right.
U.S. Constitution?
That's a big deal.
Yes or no. What do you want in that constitution or who do you want to rewrite it? In this case, they skipped the first question. They went to the second one. Who do you want to rewrite the Constitution? And imagine instead of having a yes or no vote there, you were just given a list of people all from one party that were going to do it.
Wow.
If you agreed with that party, you would be very happy. But if you didn't, you would be really dissatisfied with what was going to happen.
So it's a completely preordained electoral result. The Constitution will be rewritten. Got it.
Exactly. It was a preordained result. It was a stacked group that was going to rewrite the Constitution afterward, which is going to begin work in the next few days. Meanwhile, out in the streets, there was an extremely violent day.
The anti-government demonstrators have been calling this D-Day for a week, and they're promising it's just the start.
Someone planted a bomb in a street in the neighborhood that I used to live in. It exploded in front of a bunch of security forces.
First it comes with tear gas, and then the National Guard arrive, and they're carrying shotguns.
10 other people who were killed over the course of the day. So it was an extremely bloody day. And by the end of the evening, Maduro's people came out and said that they had prevailed, that their people had won in the constitutional vote that was pretty much predetermined, and that they would begin taking charge of the country and rewriting its governing charter. Essentially, Venezuela has got a new, almost governing junta, a body which is completely skewed towards a minority and has absolute power.
And Nick, remind us why these protests that have been escalating so much started in the first place.
These started because the country's been going for almost 2 years now with huge shortages of food and medicine.
Venezuela's economic crisis is fast becoming a humanitarian crisis. Pharmacies are running out of medicine. Lines get longer for rationed food at supermarkets. And crime is spiraling out of control.
It's because of an economic collapse, which has happened not just because of mismanagement from President Maduro and his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, but also because the price of oil has collapsed incredibly.
The global collapse of oil prices has Venezuela running on fumes.
What you have to remember about Venezuela is it is a petrostate, which means that almost all of its money and nearly every export that it makes is related to oil. Oil is the lifeblood of this country.
I think the oil prices clearly have made the situation much worse.
When the price of oil goes up, it's a bonanza in Venezuela. But when the price of the oil crashes, it's starving time there. And that's what we're seeing right now. And that's meant that Venezuelans aren't able to live their lives in any normal fashion. And for a number of months before these protests began, they were asking for early elections or for a way to recall the president, which is allowed under the Constitution. The government avoided that and instead dug even deeper into its own control. And since then, there have been almost daily protests of thousands of people, sometimes tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people on certain days.
A series of very public and very aggressive demonstrations against the economic conditions in the country, the inflation rates, the level of scarcity, and this is only going to get worse.
And Nick, you've had personal experience with Maduro's government, and we've talked about this before, and it feels like what has happened to you is pretty emblematic of everything we're seeing here.
Absolutely. I'm not able to go there right now at what's one of the most important stages of the story of Venezuela in the last few years, because the government's not allowing me to go in. For the first time in more than 12 years, the New York Times hasn't been able to even establish an office right now in Venezuela. I used to live there. I was there for about 10 months until the government kicked me out. They waited until I left the country for vacation. And then when I was coming back, they revoked my visa, deported me, and haven't allowed me to come back and even do my work. I haven't even been able to get my belongings out of my apartment since they did this.
You've been banished.
I've been banished. I've been living out of a suitcase since the beginning of the year, essentially.
And Nick, that's because of the reporting you did.
It's because of the reporting. There's no other reason that it could be. We aggressively were covering this country as much as we could, knowing that it was getting more authoritarian, knowing that this could very well be the consequence of reporting on this crisis that was coming.
So, Nick, back to these sanctions that the Trump administration has just imposed on President Maduro. How do these advance the cause of democracy there, which, as you're describing, it seems like it's slipping away?
Well, it's... Sanctions are a really tricky issue, especially when you're dealing with a country that doesn't really listen to the United States. You know, the idea is to kind of slap the president with this punishment and hope that he'll respond. The other option, which the Trump administration has got, is a lot more severe, which is to look away from sanctions against individuals and go for the jugular of Venezuela, which is its economy and its oil company, PDVSA. Trump is threatened to start economic sanctions. But the problem is, if the U.S. were to do something like impose an oil embargo against Venezuela, that would be extremely crippling for the country. And it's a hard decision both for the U.S. in terms of oil prices would go up in the U.S. And this would have a real punishing effect on average Venezuelans if America stopped buying their oil. And it's also possible that it would give a big tool to President Maduro in being able to say, look, the crisis that you're facing isn't my doing. It's actually the doing of the imperialist gringos who are out there and aren't buying the oil and are trying to destroy the country from the outside.
So the tougher sanctions, the ones that have not yet been imposed that could impact the oil industry in Venezuela, it could also backfire and hurt the American economy and its interest in oil, it sounds like.
Absolutely. You know, the U.S. almost buys half of Venezuela's oil. That's a huge amount of the American market.
Or curbing Venezuelan oil imports. Is that still on the table, or is that something that would be seen as hurting the Venezuelan people?
Let me just say, as we continue to monitor this situation, we will continue to review all of our options. Our objective is not to do anything that hurts the people of Venezuela.
So you may have some time before you actually see the U.S. take some direct action like that.
And would sanctions against oil hurt
the Venezuelan people? I'm not going to comment on that. What I will say is we will monitor all of our options.
I think the most likely things that we're going to see in the next few weeks is more attacks on, you know, Maduro's opponents, more people going out into the street. But what everybody fears is that if the opposition doesn't have a political channel to vent its anger into, if there's not the idea that an election is coming up that people are going to be able to vote in, then in a country where so many people have already got weapons that they could start to use them. Like, Venezuela is an extremely armed country. There were times where I was in hotels in Venezuela and I would see people trading pistols. It was very strange. That and a huge political crisis seemed to be a real powder keg for a country at a time where one side is trying to take absolute power over the government. The question the opposition is having to ask itself right now is, do we just go home or do we pick up arms right now? And that's a really scary question to be contemplating this week.
Early Tuesday morning, the crackdown on Maduro's political opponents intensified. Two well-known opposition leaders who had spoken out against Maduro were dragged from their homes in the middle of the night and taken to prison. We'll be right back.
I'm Jonathan Swan. I'm a White House reporter for the New York Times. I have a pretty unsentimental view of what we do. Our job as reporters is to dig out information that powerful people don't want published, to take you into rooms that you would not otherwise have access to understand how some of the big decisions shaping our country are being made. And then, painstakingly, to go back and check with sources, check with public documents, make sure the information is correct. This is not something you can outsource to AI. There's no robot that can go and talk to someone who was in the Situation Room and find out what was really said. In order to get actually original information that's not public, that requires human sources, we actually need journalists to do that. So as you may have gathered from this long riff, I'm asking you to consider subscribing to the New York Times. Independent journalism is important, and without you, we simply can't do it.
Michael Scherr, all I know about the president's new chief of staff, John Kelly, is that he's a general and that he served under the last administration too, President Barack Obama. Given that he's now been chosen by a Republican president to lead his White House, I wonder what Kelly's relationship was like with a Democratic administration.
Well, look, there were certainly times that General Kelly during the Obama administration was his blunt, outspoken self. And sometimes that didn't jive exactly with policy emanating from the White House.
For many years, it's been clear that the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay does not advance our national security.
Obviously, President Obama was a big critic of, for example, the Guantanamo prison in Cuba.
It's counterproductive to our fight against terrorists because they use it as propaganda in their efforts to recruit.
As the head of the Southern Command, Guantanamo was underneath General Kelly's purview, and he often expressed a sort of defense of the prison.
Guantanamo Naval Base is a hugely useful facility to the United States.
You know, another place where they maybe differed was that the general was often very hard-edged about immigration and the need to secure the border.
If a terrorist or almost anyone wants to get into our country, they just pay the fare. No one checks their passports. No one, you know, they don't go through metal detectors. No one cares why they're coming.
Something that, you know, President Obama was often accused of not being so tough on the border.
Tracking down, rounding up, and deporting millions of people isn't realistic. Anyone who suggests otherwise isn't being straight with you.
So it sounds like what you're describing are moments of dispute with President Obama around issues that are quite present in our lives now, securing the border, cracking down on terrorism, major issues, in fact, that President Trump cares about. Is that how the Trump administration took an interest in General Kelly.
I think that's right. When it came time for President Trump to select a Secretary of Homeland Security, John Kelly's name ultimately became the one that he picked and was sort of hailed by folks on both sides of the aisle, actually, folks even who were critics of tougher border enforcement or tougher immigration enforcement. They also saw him as a kind of person who had, at the head of Southern Command, also gotten a broad view of Mexico, Central America, South America, understood both the cultures and the politics of the place. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there was a kind of bipartisan sense that this was somebody who could sort of look at the problem of immigration, for example, in a holistic way.
So, Mike, General Kelly is picked by President Trump to be Secretary of Homeland Security, as you said. So what's he actually been doing in that role? What has he accomplished?
It's been interesting. I mean, I think the first few days of his tenure at the Department of Homeland Security was really marred by what still to this day remains one of the most chaotic and controversial moments of the Trump presidency.
Trump's travel ban prompting demonstrators to gather at terminals in New York, Los Angeles,
which was the imposition of the travel ban.
Mm-hmm.
Banned more than 100 travelers from 7 Muslim-majority countries were detained at airports in the U.S.
One of the things that was striking about that moment was that the reason it was so chaotic was that Secretary Kelly, who, as the head of the Department of Homeland Security, was responsible for all of the agents, the Border Patrol agents, mm-hmm. that should have been managing this process, he didn't even know this was happening until right before
wow.
it happened. In fact, we reported early on that he was on a plane and had dialed into a conference call into his office to sort of discuss the issue when one of his aides looked up on the television set and said, "The president is actually signing this as we speak." I mean, they literally didn't know that it was coming when it did.
That was a fascinating insight for somebody who, as we now know, has ascended to a much higher position in thinking about the organization of this White House.
Right. So his tenure essentially was born out of the kind of chaos that he's now being asked to fix, right? But I think the thing that really caught the president's eye, and President Trump has now taken to calling General Kelly the star of his administration.
Secretary of Homeland Security, incredible. One of our real stars. Truly one of our stars.
But the thing that really caught his attention was immigration enforcement, both at the border with Mexico and also in the interior of the country. So two things have happened. One is that Secretary Kelly oversaw a kind of new crackdown on immigration enforcement across the country. That was a big promise, campaign promise, that mm-hmm. President Trump made. And Secretary Kelly implemented a real crackdown that hasn't sort of created some of the headlines that past crackdowns have. So he sort of walked that line pretty effectively. And meanwhile, that crackdown has sent such a strong message south of the border mm-hmm. that the number of illegal immigrants trying to get across the border has gone way, way down in the first 6 months of the Trump presidency.
John Kelly is one of our great stars. You know, the border's down 78%.
And that has really been a good talking point for the president, mm-hmm. and I think he really credits Secretary Kelly for that.
It sounds like what you're saying is that Secretary Kelly was able to implement the most polarizing immigration and border policies of this Trump White House without being polarizing himself.
I think that's right. What Secretary Kelly avoided doing was sort of becoming the issue himself, right? And that, I think, impressed President Trump.
Got it.
One thing to note is that in this job, there have been moments where he's gotten really frustrated with the kind of chaos and general operation of the White House mm-hmm. and of the administration. There was a moment when there was a cyber attack mm-hmm. overseas. Generally speaking, Department of Homeland Security has been the agency that kind of manages and responds to cyber attacks. The White House didn't let him be the lead on that. He was very frustrated. There have been numerous occasions, I'm told, where he wanted certain personnel around him as he was building out his staff, and the White House clashed with him over who he should put in those positions. Sometimes he won, sometimes they did, but it created a real level of frustration for him. And so even in just this short time, he has been essentially on the receiving end of some of the tensions with the White House that he now is going to go in and have to try to fix.
So, Mike, everything you're telling me suggests that the White House is thrilled with General Kelly, but General Kelly is not exactly thrilled with the White House. So why do they want to take him out of his job? They say he's doing really well and have him become chief of staff. And why would he accept it, given what he knows about how difficult it might be to manage this White House?
So everybody that I've talked to about General Kelly suggests that he's motivated principally by this deep desire to serve the country. Mm-hmm. It's a military ethic that is kind of deep to his core. He's been serving for decades. His son, Lieutenant Robert Michael Kelly, was killed in Afghanistan. He was a platoon leader and he stepped on a landmine. Hmm. And so he's, you know, given the ultimate sacrifice to the country. And in fact, there's a story about the day that the president originally asked him to be part of the cabinet. He hangs up his phone and he turns to his wife and tells his wife what had just happened. And his wife says, well, that's what we do. We serve. So I think the easiest and most simple way of saying why would he do this job at the White House now is because the president asked.
And Mike, to follow up on the second part of that question, why does the White House want to pull General Kelly away from what he's been doing if he's been doing it well and it's been a priority of the president, his area of expertise?
My sense is that, as with anything, you have to sort of rank your priorities. And although the immigration and terrorism and travel ban, that all is a big priority for the president, I think they have recognized that they need to fix the much bigger problem of how the White House is organized, and they feel like he can do that.
And just to step back and ask a really basic question, what does it even mean to be chief of staff? What is this job?
You know, it can be whatever person wants. I mean, typically the most successful chiefs of staff are the ones that focus less on the chief part and more on the of staff part, right? The ones who view themselves really as a kind of day-to-day manager of a building where there is only one principal. There's really only one person that matters, and that's the president of the United States. And your job as chief of staff is to take all of the subordinates there and kind of blend them into one sort of working unit, because otherwise what you tend to have and what has clearly been evident in this White House for the first 6 months is you have people just going off on their own, messages that don't kind of mesh. You have one person on the economic side saying one thing, and that competes with somebody who's, you know, a national security priority. And what you really need is somebody to bring all that together and say all of that's going to be in service to the president and the president's agenda.
So is this a promotion? Is this a bigger deal than being Secretary of Homeland Security?
I think so. I mean, look, you can certainly make the case that from a sheer size perspective, being the head of the Department of Homeland Security is a much bigger job in terms of managing numbers of people. You're managing literally tens of thousands of people spread all around the country and, frankly, all around the world probably. The White House is, in sort of geographically and size-wise, a much smaller operation. But look, it's at the heart of everything that this administration does. And in terms of being remembered for shaping not just one part of an administration but an entire administration, I think it's a much bigger job in that from that perspective.
Michael, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, happy to do it anytime.
Here's what else you need to know today. The Trump administration is preparing to look into discrimination toward white students applying to colleges and universities. The Times obtained a document, an internal announcement to the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, that shows the White House plans to redirect resources towards investigating and suing universities over affirmative action admission policies that are found to discriminate against white applicants. The announcement seeks lawyers interested in working on, quote, a new project. And bypassing President Trump and his threats to cripple the Affordable Care Act, congressional Republicans have begun working with Democrats on a plan to stabilize the law instead. Senate Health Committee Chairman Lamar Alexander, a Republican, and the committee's vice chair, Patty Murray, a Democrat, will hold hearings on a possible bill next week.
Thank you very much, Chairman Alexander. I think it's really clear that the path to improving health care, lowering premiums, and increasing access and quality has to be through working across the aisle and bringing patients and families into the process and coming together to find common ground.
Finally,
any senator wish to change their vote? On this nomination, the yeas are 92, the nays are 5. The nomination is confirmed.
The Senate has confirmed President Trump's choice to lead the FBI, Christopher Wray, a former Justice Department official in the Bush administration, filling a position that has remained vacant since May, when the president fired James Comey. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.